My name is Michael McCusker. Today I'm going to do something personal on this show. This is the 52nd anniversary of the day I joined, enlisted in the USMC. I was 17 and was in the reserves too. I stuck my toe into the water instead of plunging my whole body in. But 6 years later, I re-enlisted for Vietnam for 2 years. But my mother was very displeased at me enlisting. But my father, after I got out of boot camp and my first 6 months of training, said, well, at least they've taught you how to walk correctly. But both of them did not like my choice of going to Vietnam, and I've always honored them for that. But also today, while in Vietnam, a very close friend of mine was killed. And I have discovered that this year, in days, parallels the year 1966. My friend was killed on Thursday, that today is. And I'd like to read something I wrote about him. I call it the seventh day of the seventh month. And I've got to say that this is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only. This is my disclaimer. In the entire cosmos and parallel universes, and maybe even Victor Llewellyn Payne might disagree with what I've written about him and other things I shall read today. Today, Victor Llewellyn Payne, aka Eagle Beak and Banana Nose, died 45 years ago at the age of 20. We were reporters and photographers for the 1st Marine Division and were out in the paddies and jungles of South Vietnam with different infantry units on simultaneous search and destroy operations that July Thursday in 1966. Payne was with Albert Mitchell, another USMC combat correspondent, with the 7th Marines. I was with my favorite outfit, Charlie Company 1st Battalion 5th Marines, under the command of Captain Marshall Buckingham Darling, by far the best officer I knew in the USMC. That afternoon today, 45 years ago, Payne was with one infantry company, Mitchell with another. As Mitchell was later to piece together, the company Payne accompanied had stopped for a rest in a small village. A South Vietnamese army interpreter thought he saw a booby trap in a tree. Ever intensely inquisitive, Payne, whom we had dubbed the Master of Trivia, pulled at a branch to better see the object of the Vietnamese soldier's concern. The subsequent explosion killed him, ripping off his head and right arm, killing also several others, including the observant Vietnamese. A low-flying Huey helicopter gunship pilot later said that he had flown just above the blast and saw what he described as bodies and parts of bodies flying through the air. I was told of Payne's death by a captain in the 1st Battalion, 5th Marine Headquarters, who had been relieved of company command because he had refused to send his troops up a hill he was certain was mined and booby-trapped. Though his superiors were displeased with him, he was held in high respect by enlisted men and a few of his officer peers, which included Buck Darling. Services were held for Payne a few days later. Until I left for Japan 7 months afterward, a memorial was kept for him in the division press office at Chulai. We had done the same for Les Wiesian, the first Marine combat correspondent killed in Vietnam a few weeks before I arrived in country. He had been killed evacuating wounded when he was shot in the head. His rifle was propped against a tent pole in what was then the division press office our first few months in Vietnam. Division headquarters had then been in tents perched on a crest of a cliff that fell steeply into the South China Sea. The ocean wind that blew over the cliffs kept the place well ventilated, and the camp was situated among copses of spindly pine trees that kept it well shaded. That pleasant place was only temporary. Permanent division headquarters was constructed in a swampy slough in which there was no wind or shade against the broiling sun, and which flooded and became a sewer of red mud during the monsoon season, a tribute to military genius. When we moved to our new office, a plywood hut with unglassed screens covered with a corrugated aluminum roof, we lost Wiesian's rifle. Payne's memorial was a few bits and pieces of things he left behind. His twisted and shattered glasses, his blood-stained notebook detailing the operation up to his death. These were placed in an old wood and glass Japanese geisha doll case and put on top of a file cabinet in the new office. In about 2 months, all of the men he had come across the Pacific with were gone, most of them back to the States. Two of them, Julius Maxwell Belcher and Nick Overlocker, went back to Okinawa, where the group had been stationed for 6 months before shipping down south to Vietnam. None except for Payne were dead, nor any evacuated wounded. In October, the division moved its headquarters north to Da Nang. I was to follow, but my commanding officer prevailed over his general that I remain in Chulai, where at the time Marines were having their most troubles with the Viet Cong. Though I was seldom in the office for many months, generally out among the infantry outfits, I was always able to convince whoever was office-bound to keep the memorial in good shape. By then, our luck had changed, and several reporters and photographers had been wounded, but none more dead as yet, until Byron Hyland, who was killed in February 1967, with the writer-historian Bernard Fall, author of Street Without Joy, The French Indochina War Against Ho Chi Minh and the Viet Minh, 1946 to 1954, and Hell in a Very Small Place, The French Defeat at Dien Bien Phu in 1954. I am sure that after I left Vietnam, Payne's memorial was finally discarded. His name, all of our names, must have quickly receded as others replaced us and fought their wars within the war. Payne was 20 when he was killed today, 45 years ago. He would be 65 now, perhaps recently retired from what he might have done as his life's work. Given his lively and ever-curious mind, it would probably have been interesting. He might have had grandchildren by now. For a long time after Payne's death, I was haunted by the fact that the number 7 was present 4 times in respect with his death. He was killed on the 7th day of the 7th month with a company from 7th Marines, and that day was the 7th anniversary of my enlisting in the USMC in 1959. Also, the designation of the company he was with, M Company, is the same as my name, Mike. Superstitious at the time, certain my death was imminent, I thought within those 7s was a message of my doom. 4.5 decades afterward, in a new century, on this 52nd anniversary of my enlistment, I yet wonder and wait. And that was something I wrote the 7th day of the 7th month. I'd like to continue along in the same venue. And with something I wrote, and a couple of things if I have the time. But I guess I'd like to warn whoever's listening that what I'm about to read, not only is it my opinion, and my opinion only perhaps in the entire cosmos, but it's also pretty rough. It's rough reading. So, a little bloody, I might say. So, if you decide not to have that over your morning coffee and pastry, I suggest turning the channel, maybe over to KCPB. The classical station, one of our satellites, of course. I call this one Ambush. We were hit, sucked in and trapped. Machine gun and rifle fire caressed us, lacing through bodies in interweaving patterns, rendering us a rich harvest of snared death. The hollow lumps of mortar shattered human beings and mud-thatched huts. Screams and shouts for medical corpsmen rattled against the terrible clatter of killing. I dived into a bell-shaped haystack, the only cover I could find in the second I needed some place to hide. The bodies of 2 dead Marines were in front of me. One of them had collapsed the mud wall of a hut as he fell through, and his body was covered with clods and thatch from the caved-in roof. The other Marine lay in the open street, his blood spraying like a lawn sprinkler. I was numb and sick with instant terror, convulsed with choking, dry nausea and dysentery. I felt hot, sticky liquid steaming down the backs of my legs as I pushed my face into the dirt underneath the haystack and closed my eyes. Bullets scythed through the haystack, chopping it to pieces. Mortars crashed nearby, and chunks of hot steel pimpled the ground around me, some of them spanging over my head and setting the haystack to smoldering. I heard a low moaning, for a second vacantly thinking it was someone wounded, realizing it was my voice, whimpering in terror. I wanted no part of the horror suddenly bursting all around me. I wanted to scream for them to stop, to get away from us, to leave us alone. I wanted to get up and run, screaming for them to let me live. "Pick up your rifle, you yellow bastard!" My eyes popped open and I jerked my head from the dirt. The voice had shrieked so stridently, so clearly, I was certain someone was in the haystack with me. But no one was. The shout was a spear from my guts. Numb with terror, I watched from somewhere else as I pulled my M14 rifle to my shoulder. I was shaking so badly I triggered a round, not caring where it went. I fired again, just as wildly, and again. The sound and recoil against my shoulder began to calm me, a familiar rhythm that folded the shattered parts of my mind, one onto another. I slowly felt I might have something to do with saving myself. Bullets continued to tear through the smoldering haystack, but I started to notice they were too high to hit me. I wrenched my body around to see where they were coming from. From ditches and hedgerows we had crossed entering the village only moments before. From concealed tunnels and spider holes we had carelessly not seen. Machine guns and rifles barked at us from everywhere, butchering us like pigs in a pen, the same kind of trap we always failed to catch the Viet Cong in. I could see some of what was happening through the haystack. I saw Marines starting to assault their ambushers, some alone, some in teams, savagely fighting for their lives. I heard our machine guns and rifles returning fire, raggedly at first, then pouring torrents into the ditches and tree lines. I heard the distinct popping of grenade launchers. The paralysis and terror of the first few seconds was being thrown off by the need to kill before being killed. All over the village, wherever they were pinned, behind or in between huts, in the dirt streets, sprawled behind trees or bushes, Marines fired their weapons and charged the Viet Cong, a few falling but the rest leapfrogging from cover to cover. Their black, white, and brown faces under oversized green splotched bowls were grim and terrified. They shouted curses and commands or screamed in pain or for help. I emptied a magazine into a tree line, slammed another into the rifle and emptied it also. I reached into my cartridge belt for a third magazine and saw a head bob up and down in the window of a hut several yards to my right. I loaded the rifle and squirmed around, then fired straight into the mud wall and open window until the magazine was empty and the wall was a mess of holes with large chunks falling inside. The head disappeared. I concentrated on the tree line again, wishing I could get away from the haystack. The bullets chewing it up were still high, but I knew I would be hit the moment I moved. There was nothing to do but lay in the dirt and shoot up my ammunition, hoping to not hit Marines getting closer to the trench line the trees concealed and that the haystack wouldn't catch fire. I saw an officer shout for some men to assault the trenches with him, but a grenade got him. A medical corpsman died trying to reach him. More grenades started exploding, these hurled by Marines who survived getting within range of Viet Cong guns and mortars. The fire slackened and I jumped to my feet and raced out from the haystack, outraged and wanting revenge for my terror. I joined other Marines charging from all parts of the village, splashing across a muddy stream and plunging wildly into hedgerows and trenches. I had no other thought than to make the Viet Cong pay for what they had done to me, though nothing had been done to me. I felt like a Viking berserker, those ancient wild men who charged their enemies with battle axes. But there were no enemies to kill. They vanished underground into their tunnels. We were thwarted and frustrated. Some of the Marines screamed obscenities into the tunnels and threw in grenades, but none crawled after the retreating enemies who dragged their dead and wounded with them. Going after them was sure death. We had once more taken possession of the overground, but they owned the underground. A single dead Viet Cong to bayonet and kick might have lessened our raging impotence. Blood and parts of bodies were around some of the holes or in the trenches, but that was all. I once more felt a dread of fighting an alien people who burrowed beneath the earth and emerged only to shoot us down. I thought the whole country might be honeycombed with intricate tunnel systems, and I shivered with a fear that at any time or place they could come out of the ground and kill us. An officer shouted for us to help with the wounded. I could hear shouts for medical corpsmen echoing through the village, and I heard also men shouting to one another for assurance their friends were unhurt. Walking back across the stream, I saw a Marine trying to crawl from a mortared hut. One hand clutched his abdomen. Blood and intestines surged through his fingers. His wretched face was pale. His eyes were wide with anguish and disbelief. I bent over him and helplessly reached for his bandage pouch. A choking spasm wrenched his body and a gush of blood erupted from his mouth, and he died. I stood and shook my head at a corpsman running up. He changed direction and ran over to a man laying across the splintered bamboo rails of an abandoned water buffalo pen. I walked into the mortared hut. The roof had been blown off, and most of it covered the body of another Marine. He and the man who died in the street must have ducked into the hut the moment the Viet Cong opened up. The mortar shell blew out the back wall and killed them, though one lived long enough to crawl a few feet. I remembered the head I had seen bobbing in another hut. I walked past the bell-shaped haystack that had saved my life. It was still smoldering. White, acrid smoke blew into my face as I passed, stinging my eyes and causing me to cough. I reached the hut and eased through the doorway into the cool and dim interior, holding my rifle ready to shoot. A body lay soaked in blood on the dirt floor near the window and bullet-torn wall. It was clad in black pajamas. Half the back of its head was a bloody mush, and blood smeared the pajamas. I looked for a rifle or any sort of weapon. None. I walked to the window and used my rifle butt to turn the body over on its back. The head flopped at a crazy angle onto the right shoulder. I looked down into the flaxen, wrinkled face of an old woman. Her mouth was open, her ancient teeth stained with betel nut. Her eyes were wide open, and the last second of her terror was still livid in them. Just beneath her left eye, almost touching her nose, was a red hole. Drying blood sluggishly streamed down her cheek and dripped off her jaw onto her shoulder. I felt a great shudder slump through my body, replaced by hot anger and hatred I knew was unreasonable. I blamed her for her death. She should not have been there. She should not have stuck her head up so often. It was her own fault I killed her. I stood over her stiffening body, asking over and over why her people couldn't just leave us alone. Why did they have to kill or cripple us, these strange people who lived in tunnels and jungles, these phantoms who haunted us with their hatred for us? I was horrified by them. I hated them for hating us. I hated her and all her people that instant, as if it was their fault we were in their homes, killing them and being killed by them. "Can't you see we just want to go home?" I demanded she understand. "Can't you understand we never wanted to come here?" I knew that I could not escape the present by wishing for something else or by escaping into my memories. I was trapped in a whirlwind, and I didn't know how to get out of it. Sometimes I wished I would die because I was getting so tired of being afraid to die. "Maybe you're the lucky one," I whispered to her. The afternoon sunlight through the window and bullet holes in the wall began to tinge her face with the barest traces of gold. Shouts outside the hut startled me. I felt I had been deaf since entering. Voices spoke or shouted in English, my language, my people. They were all that I had, all I could return to. I stepped back outside the hut. I felt a stickiness at the back of my pants, and embarrassed and flushed, remembered my terror. I walked through the village oblivious to the broken, bleeding bodies of the dead, the whimpers and moans of the wounded being carried on makeshift litters or on the backs of Marines to a place where the helicopters could evacuate them. I paid no attention to the angry, hate-twisted faces of other Marines setting fire to what was left of the village. I did not think of the old woman. My only thought was that I had soiled my pants and I wanted to wash it away in the stream before anyone noticed. And that was something I wrote. It was more or less a composite of several firefights in villages and ambushes. And it's no less true for that. I just bunched a few together. And I called it Ambush. It's sort of a Vietnam vignette. I'd like to read now something else that I wrote. I call it Charles and Sheila. And it more or less takes place after I'm back from Vietnam. After Charles killed himself, Sheila was given severe abuse for having left him. I did not know either of them very well, but thought it absurd to blame her. Charles, whatever his reason, chose to end his life. If she was responsible for his choice, it was none of my business, or those who attempted to shame her. I respect people who decide to leave life. I believe suicide to be somewhat premature, but some people can't wait, although there is much wisdom in the cliché that things might seem better if one waited until the next morning. I do think it foolish to kill oneself to make someone suffer. To kill oneself so that someone else is blamed equates absurdity with the unconscionable. I was harshly critical of a few people who blamed Sheila for Charles's death, and she heard about it. I bumped into her one day a few months later, and she asked if I had time to join her for a drink. We sat at a table in a nearby bar. She told me about Charles, an explanation of why he stayed away from women for many years. "He was a nice man, I thought," she said. "Too nice to continually punish himself for being in Vietnam." "So what?" I said to him. "Thousands of people were there. Millions of others weren't. Why should only a few think they have to carry everybody else's guilt? Who do you think you are?" I told him. "Jesus Christ?" Well, after that, what else could I do but hop in the sack with him? She laughed. We were good lovers. He had a lot of making up for, and I didn't mind a bit. We were almost happy, but that shadow he carried around wouldn't leave him. I kept telling him it couldn't be that bad, and whatever it was, no matter how horrible, he couldn't let him paralyze him or ruin his life. He might as well shoot himself. I told him that, but we both laughed after I said it, and he said, "Yeah, I guess so." A bartender brought us drinks. "You might as well get me another one," she said, "because I'll be done with this one before you get back." She drank half a glass of white wine in a swallow. She stared at me for a few moments. "He finally told me," she said. "Maybe he waited too long. By then I had stopped thinking it was the war in general. You know, bombing innocent people or killing people whose bodies were dragged off and nobody was ever sure. I started thinking it was something he did personally, something he couldn't face up to. He used to say people made a big deal out of killing when they found out he was a vet. They always asked him. Hell, they accused him with the question, treated him like he was a murderer. How could he kill?" they'd ask him. He would get furious. It was the wrong question. Killing was easy. Not killing was the hard part. That's why wars are so easy to start and almost impossible to stop. He used to tell me about army shrinks, how it was their job to cure men who didn't want to kill by instilling in them the sanity of murder. That's why VA shrinks don't do veterans any good. They're the same guys who said a man was crazy if he didn't want to kill for Christ and country. Now the vets who are ashamed and want to get rid of their nightmares for doing all the killing they did are sent to these damned shrinks who told them to kill. She finished the wine just as the bartender came up with her second glass and ordered a third. She held the glass tightly in a fist. One night after we made love, Charles started talking almost as if he couldn't stop. He had been part of a squad sent into a village to capture a woman who was accused of being a Viet Cong Mata Hari. The squad was run by a private who was cold as ice. The squad leader was a sergeant who was worthless. When the private got the idea they ought to rape the woman, all of them, everybody taking a turn at her, the sergeant said they shouldn't and started to pray for their souls, but he didn't do anything to stop it. Charles said they just left him on his knees and went into the village. There was only one young woman there. The rest of the women, about a dozen, were all old. They raped the girl, every damned one of them. The private took a second turn after everybody else was finished, then he shot her in the head. The old people were rounded up, and the private convinced the others the old people had to be killed, or the girl's rape and murder would be found out. The old people were pushed inside a hut and shot. Then they burned the hut with the bodies inside. Charles said they reported to an officer who wanted to know why the woman was dead. They wanted her alive. Charles said the officer got real angry when he learned a bunch of old people were killed and demanded to be taken to the village. Charles said he saw the burnt bodies in the hut and went ballistic. He said everybody was court-martialed and went to jail, but everybody except the private got out after only doing 6 months. He said he got kicked out of the army with only a bad conduct discharge, which he said was pretty lucky. Sheila took a long swallow of the second wine. After Charles finished his story, he started crying and clung to me like I was his mother. I was repulsed. I didn't want him to touch me. I never wanted him to touch me again. When I was sure he was asleep, I got up, dressed in the bathroom. It was his place. And I left and never went back. She looked at me with a grim smile. He begged me to go back to him many times, she said, but he disgusted me, and I never did. It wasn't raping the girl that shocked me so much. That's what war's all about, isn't it? Maybe I could have forgiven him for that, and he didn't know the private was going to kill her. But when he helped kill those old people just because they might tell somebody, and then burned them, that made my skin crawl. So maybe that's why he killed himself. I don't know. She finished the second wine. Instead of grasping the third glass, she ran her finger around its rim and looked past me. Maybe I shouldn't have been his lover. He might have done okay if it wasn't for me. I think I made him too vulnerable. He finally had to tell me what he did, and maybe he couldn't live with it when I rejected him for it. She got up from the table. She said goodbye and left the third wine untouched. And a short one here, VC Girl. An old weathered skeleton of an unfinished French cathedral in Quang Nai shivered against wind-lashed rain one morning in early October. The first winter monsoons were crossing the backbone of the Annamites and shoveling across the deltas to the South China Sea. Blue smoke from charcoal fires throughout the city danced in the streets almost like a ground fog, flattened by the wind and rain. Soldiers and Marines in the military compound waited at attention for the morning flag raising. The Americans stood at one corner of the parade ground with their flag, the Arvins on the other with their flag. Bent into the wind, I walked down a muddy side street past a small paint-peeling temple, a few ramshackle bars and several crumbling French colonial-style homes with families sitting on the porches as the street curved toward the river. Up ahead, fronting the swollen, muddy Song Truc River, a line of shacks coveyed beneath the many times blown-up bridge. Fish hung from the eaves of each house to dry for salting. Because it was too wet and windy to set up at the marketplace a few streets over, families hawked their fish or produce from porches. Soldiers and army vehicles continually crossed the bridge, and here and there a bent old woman carried rice baskets suspended from a pole on her shoulders. I walked to one of the houses and knocked on a wooden door. It opened a crack, and a questioning pretty face cautiously peered into mine. Her name was Lon. She and a friend of mine were going together. She smiled and opened the door for me to enter. I took off my dripping hat and stepped into a single room. Her mother was in a corner, hunched over a fire, cooking rice. "You have to go," I said. "Billy come. Think you VC." "What's mean? Him think me VC," she hissed in wide-eyed shock. "You think me VC? No matter what I think. Him think you VC. Come to kill you. Why him think me? Him have names. Dead VC have. Your name on list. When have? Yesterday. Soon police come. But he come first. Kill you. Why him kill me? You know. Because him think you liar. Use love. Me no do. Okay. No matter. Just Didi. Why you come me?" she insisted. "You think me VC? Why no come police?" I shrugged. "It doesn't matter. I just come to warn you. He come soon. Now Didi." That means get out. She stood unmoving, looking at me as I walked to the door. I looked back and smiled a little. "Good luck," I said, and stepped out into the rain and down the street along the river. I tipped her off because I was sick of it, because the fact I liked her. I was beginning to think Lon and her brothers and sisters were right. She was gone that afternoon. The police took away her family and beat up her father. A few days later, the family was allowed to return home. I never saw Lon again. "Somebody must have tipped her off, that's all I can say," Billy cursed over a beer back at Chulai that night. "If I ever get my hands on that whore, I'll kill her." And that was VC Girl. And I guess that should end it. You've been listening to A Story Told. I'm Michael McCusker.